Good evening. Welcome, everybody, first of all, on this very sort of cold evening. Much warmer in here. I'm Christine Chinkin. I'm director of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security here at the LSE. And I'm delighted to be chairing, well, delighted to welcome you all first, and delighted to be chairing this event, which is a celebration, I think, really, of Dr. Poonam Yadav's, that's the last time I'm going to call you by your full name, Poonam, book on social transformation in post-conflict Nepal, a gender perspective. Here is the book. Do you want to wave it around as well?
I've got the paper
back. Right. So we very beautifully produced book. And it is available, I'll say now, at a discount, 20% discount level with a code number. And there's paper outside that tells you that. So if people would like to pick up that, obviously very, very welcome. I think this is a book that sort of sticks in your mind once you've read it. Obviously, the title tells you that it's about the aftermath of the decade-long war, civil war, in Nepal, which was from 1996 to 2006. But I think what's really striking about it, and this will be developed far more by the speakers on the panel, are the images and memories of the women who are included in the book. And the book takes a bottom-up approach to sort of social science research, and it's absolutely imbued with the richness, the complexities, the contradictions of women's lives in the aftermath of conflict. I think once you've read it, you'll all remember Dev the Tea Lady, who figures very strongly in it. And the image of her drinking in a public place, drinking tea with other women in a public space. In, I presume it was Kathmandu. Was it Kathmandu? It was Kathmandu. I was going to say, I don't remember where it actually was. And your comment in the book that you really could not believe what you were seeing, that you really couldn't compute in your own mind this social transformation where a woman, a tea lady, is out there drinking, and then where she goes from that afterwards. And I mean, that is just one cameo, although it does figure quite strongly in the book, but it gives you a feeling of, say, the richness and the complexity of the book. But the other speakers are far more qualified than I am to speak about the book. So what I will do is introduce three of them quickly. They will all then speak for 10 minutes or so, and then we'll have time for questions and discussions about the book and perhaps more generally. So I think another important point about it is that, yes, it is about Nepal, but I think the messages that you're getting over are, in fact, broader than that and far offer useful lessons for women, peace and security, post-conflict and so on in general. So the first speaker is my colleague, the author of the book, Poonam Yadav. She's a research fellow at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. She came to us from Sydney University, where she was a member at the Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies, and has had a long experience working in Nepal as a development practitioner and working with various national NGOs. So Poonam will introduce really her coming to the book and how she has developed it. And then the second speaker on my left is David Gellner, who is Professor of Social Anthropology and a Fellow of All Souls College at the University of Oxford, and a very long-term worker, worker on
issues. Very old.
I wouldn't dream of saying that. But we've been working for a long time researching on Nepal from a whole variety of different topics: religion, caste, ethnicity, politics, spirit possession, borders. And the author and editor of many books on Nepal, most recently Religion, Secularism and Ethnicity in Contemporary Nepal, which is 2016 book. So welcome, especially to the LSE and to the Centre. We're delighted that you're here tonight. And then the third speaker on my third left far left, is another of my colleagues, Dr. Marcia Henry, who is Deputy Director for the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. She is an expert on issues relating to women, peace and security, post-conflict aspects, particularly peacekeeping aspects, author of many articles, and co-conspirator on many issues relating to women, peace and security. So I will hand over to you, Poonam, to start.
Thank you, Christine. I got cold last night and it had to happen today, so I have some itchy throat, so I might be coughing every now and again, and I'm having this hot water. Christine already has summarized about the book, and I'm going to just highlight some of the key arguments of the book.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
So when we talk about women in war, we end up feeling sad and depressed because of the stories of pain and suffering. But there is another side to the story. Women are not always victims of war. They are also agents of change. However, the agency aspect of the story often gets ignored or undervalued, which has significant impact on post-conflict interventions. In my book, I look at women's agency in post-People's War Nepal. More specifically, I examine unintended positive consequences of the People's War on women, which has contributed to social transformation in Nepal. My research journey began in 2009 with an informal discussion with a group of friends in Nepal. We discussed the consequences of the People's War in Nepal, which started in 1996, as Christine said, and ended with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2006. It was an intense conversation we had, where we all agreed that armed conflict, even with political motives, was certainly not the best way to achieve one's goal. However, we also discussed that the armed conflict could have positive impacts on people as well as in society, and it may provide opportunities for empowerment, especially for marginalized and socially discriminated groups. Therefore, the initial interest was to explore the positive impacts of conflict on women, but later my research interest shifted from the perceived positive impacts of conflict to the notion of social transformation. As my research journey progressed, I realized that a positive and negative dichotomy as applied to impacts of war did not capture the multiplicity and complex nature of people's lived experience. People's experience of conflict can be simultaneously positive and negative. For instance, women performing different roles in diverse socioeconomic and geographical locations experience people's war in Nepal differently. The focus of this research project then became to explore the fluid and dynamic social processes and to understand the dynamics of social change. As a result of the post-war changes and people's expectations about building a new Nepal, the term social transformation had become a buzzword. Everyone would talk about social transformation in Nepal. In every events, in all the social media, people would talk about social transformation, bringing social transformation in new Nepal. There were some NGOs which were established only to bring social transformation in Nepal. Likewise, there were other NGOs and other organizations working to bring social transformation through their areas of expertise. For instance, social transformation through music, through social transformation through community forestry, social transformation through education, and so on. So the term social transformation in post-People's War Nepal had not only received attention from NGOs, activists, and political leaders, it had also caught the attention of academics. The academic studies suggested that positive social change was taking place in Nepal. However, they suggested that social transformation is a long way away. During the course of my study, I observed changed attitude among people in two respects. There was an increased recognition of discrimination based on gender, caste, and class among general public. And there was a desire to bring social transformation by improving the conditions of those discriminated against. Interestingly, those people who were talking about social transformation spoke as if they wanted to transform the society, the world, that one was different to where they were living. And something needed to be done by them in order to transform the society. These shifts in people's perception about caste and gender were significant. However, the way it was understood led me to question how the discourse of social transformation was constructed in Nepal. What were the indicators that determined whether social transformation had occurred, and what was the basis for choosing those indicators? Why were some indicators weighted more heavily than others, and why indicators were so important to study social transformation? So in my initial research, I found out that there were no such studies carried out so far. So in post-conflict, post-people's war, I shouldn't say post-conflict Nepal, because there are still conflicts going on in various forms. So in post-people's war Nepal, social transformation was clearly visible to me on the streets, in the villages. Women were driving tempu, it's a three-wheel vehicle, which was unheard of before the war. Women were being recruited for combat roles in the Nepal army. Widows didn't have to wear white sari anymore. Social transformation also became increasingly visible in political sphere, where women and marginalized groups were included in mainstream politics. People from lower castes with no political background, women with no formal education, were actually being nominated and elected for Constituent Assembly. These changes represent significant developments in Nepalese history and a radical departure from deep-rooted socio-cultural and political traditions. Yet these radical shifts seemed underreported and undervalued in much of the popular writing about social transformation in Nepal. These developments and discursive changes were also largely ignored by the organizations working to bring social transformation in Nepal, which became the basis for my investigation. My book actually explores the ways in which social transformation might be understood and its underlying dynamics constructed if women's lived experience were the basis for were the foundation for theorizing. By providing alternative bottom-up approach to a study of social transformation, there is a focus on individual lived experience as well as perceived collective social change. I aim to deconstruct the existing understanding of social transformation by placing women's lived experience at the center of my analysis. Therefore, instead of going to field with predetermined indicators, I listen to many women's stories of how their lived reality had changed. So the writing of this book has been possible because of the support from various institutions and individuals. I'm grateful to the Center for Women, Peace and Security for hosting me as a visiting fellow while I was finishing my book. Thanks to Marsh and David for taking the time to review and comment on my book. Thanks to the WPS team, special thanks to Joey and Yale for organizing everything for today. And thank you, Christine, for your continued support.
Pleasure.
And thanks to my children who have come all the way from Australia. And thank you all of you for coming to this event and being part of the journey, part of my journey. Thank you.
Thank you, Poonam. And for being so open about it, you know, as the journey. So, David.
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you for asking me to talk about this book and celebrate. Obviously, as an anthropologist, I'm thrilled with the focus on women, with the focus on change, with the focus on lived experience, and politics and so on. There's the case studies include the tempo drivers of Kathmandu and the women. Members of the Constituent Assembly, that's important, certainly. Those things have been written about. For me, what's really important and possibly kind of unintended, as it were, by Poonam herself, is the fact that here is a book about Nepal where it is utterly taken for granted that the Terai is a full part of Nepal and is sort of central to the analysis. Not separate, not marginalised, but is actually part of the central analysis. So that may be obvious to her. You may not know what the hell I'm talking about. I'm going to try and explain. But for those of us who work on Nepal and have been kind of consuming books about Nepal for many decades, as you've indicated, this is actually quite revolutionary. So the Terai, and the reason that Poonam's able to do this, of course, is that she is from the Terai. That is to say, in the new term, which certainly didn't exist, or no, that's not right, it did exist, but wasn't used when I first went to Nepal back in the 1970s, she is a Madeshi. That means she's from originally, or at least her family is originally from, the southern plains. So that's the strip of Gangetic Plain that is part of Nepal, which has a, so there's a, I'm supposed to know this by heart, but anyway, it's over 1,000 kilometres long, this border with India. And it's completely open. It's a border which is not a border. It's it doesn't behave like any other kind of border in South Asia. It's not like the border with Pakistan, which has got this massive fence and is militarised. It's not like the border with India, between India and Bangladesh, where they're building this enormous barbed wire fence to try and keep the Bangladeshis in. It's open. You can just walk across it. It's not open for goods, but it is open for people, at least not for people like me, but it's open for people who are Nepalese or Indians. They can simply walk across it with no controls whatsoever. So that's a very important sort of geostrategic fact, which means that the relationship between Nepal and India is very close, but of course it's not really very equal because of the different sizes. And there is a deep, deep problem, which is the single most important problem that the Nepali state now faces, and will face, I think, I would predict, for the next century, which is the fact that, now depending on how you define Madeshi, between 15% and 50% of the country belongs to the Terai. And the core Madeshis are people who, in their language and culture, are identical to people on the other side of the border, and therefore are perceived by people in the hills as being, quote-unquote, Indians and not Nepalis, although they themselves have been born in Nepal, have Nepali citizenship, etc., etc. So that is the kind of key sort of ethnographic and geostrategic fact which underlies the kind of basic conflict which is burning up in Nepal at the moment, which tore Nepal apart in the second half of 2015, and which is absolutely crucial for the future of the country. So part of the book is about the women of Poonam's home village in Siraha, close to the Indian border. And not only that, it's about the fact that although and one of the claims of the Madeshi activists and politicians is that the hills of Nepal, the Kathmandu, the capital, have treated the Terai like an internal colony. So they've extracted surplus from it. The aristocrats of the hills of Nepal have had big estates in the Terai, so they've extracted surplus from it. They have invested nothing in it, and this narrative of internal colonialism and exploitation has enormous traction in the Terai because for several reasons. First of all, they all have relatives across the border, and they often frequently go across the border, and they can see what life is like in India. Now, you may think that Bihar and Uttar Pradesh are backward, underdeveloped and incredibly poor places, and so they are by global standards. But compared to the Nepalese Terai, they're dynamic, forward-looking, and have high levels of education. Every village has a tarmac road to it, and so on. And there have been positive discrimination, in other words, what South Asians called reservations, for Dalits and low castes for a very long time. So there have been all kinds of measures to try and help the backward, and all kinds of state regime, to state schemes like NREGA and so on, which simply don't exist in Nepal. So they can simply look over the border and say, look, it's obvious the Nepali state has invested nothing in us. But the second reason, and it feels like internal colonialism, is that all the organs of the state, the police, the bureaucracy, the army, are all manned by people from the hills. Traditionally, Madeshis were not recruited into these bodies. And so whenever they go to an office and try to get a citizenship paper, or they get their land registered or sold or whatever, they have to deal with these hill bureaucrats who treat them with disdain because they're Madeshis. So they have a kind of daily experience which reinforces this narrative. And now, at the same time, of course, being the Nepalese Terai and having the same social structure and languages over the border, it is a deeply caste-based society. And because there has been no modernization and much less education and no positive discrimination as in India, therefore the position of low castes in the Nepalese Terai is really very pitiful. And I had reason to see this a couple of years ago when I did some fieldwork on the other side of the border, and I also visited Bangalore in the south, and I revisited the famous village that M.N. Srinivas studied in his classic book, The Remembered Village. And I also did work on the Nepalese side of the Terai. So within a month, I'd been in all three places. And the contrast between the position of Dalits in South India, the position of Dalits in Eastern UP, and the position of Dalits in the Nepalese Terai was enormous. And the Dalits in the Nepalese Terai are living in shacks, sort of straw shacks, basically, with no land whatsoever and virtually destitute. At least those in the Eastern UP have certain government schemes, and in the case that I saw, a school run by the followers of Vivekananda, specifically dedicated to Musaha children, and so on. And South India, completely different. South India, we've had decades of advance and kind of government initiatives, so that the whole experience, the whole lived experience, as Poonam puts it, of being a Dalit was really quite different. In that context, the story that Poonam tells about her home village and the rise of the woman who used to be their servant and her becoming a Constituent Assembly member and a powerful person in her own right and an empowered person is really quite extraordinary. And so I would definitely I would encourage her to continue with this work, to go into it in even greater detail. I think this is for me what makes the book really powerful. This detailed consideration of caste, class, and female empowerment in the Terai, and the fact that this woman Devi, who's become an MP, can now sit in a Yadav sitting room, that is something that would never have happened before. Poonam also talks about female participation in the Maoist movement. This is also one of the Nepalese Maoist movement is again extraordinary. It's the envy of left-leaning sitting rooms throughout the subcontinent. Gosh, you know, I was said, because I'm a Sri Lankan intellectual, how did they manage to do it? We've been trying to do this for years, and they managed to have such a powerful Maoist movement. Now, of course, now that they've come into the mainstream and compromised with the mainstream of Nepalese politics, they are rather less the toast of left-leaning intellectuals because they've tainted themselves with compromise. But it certainly was extraordinary. It came virtually from nowhere. Within 10 years, it came to dominate 80% of the countryside. They fought the kind of Nepalese army to a standstill. Neither side could win. Extraordinarily, India brokered the peace treaty, which brought them back into the mainstream and guaranteed gave all the guarantees on both sides. Of course, the other person we have to thank for the fact that Nepal was able to get out of this quagmire was King Gyanendra. So King Gyanendra, it is impossible to exaggerate just how stupid he was, and whenever he had two choices, a sensible choice and a stupid choice, he unfailingly chose the stupid choice and confined his own dynasty to the dustbin of history thereby, and pushed the political parties into the arms of the Maoists, so they united against him. So that's the great achievement of the Maoists. On the gender question, how was it? One of the extraordinary things in comparative perspective is that the Nepalese Maoists had about a third or more even of women fighters. If you look worldwide, that is really extraordinary. And how do you explain that? I explain it in this way, by a combination of two factors. First, in the culture of the hills, this is a kind of stereotype, but there's a lot of truth in it. Compared to the plains, the culture of the hills is much more egalitarian. Now, that is not to say men and women have equal status in hill societies, absolutely not. Nonetheless, the degree of female subordination is much less, and particularly among the Janajatis, that's to say the groups that used to be hill tribes, the degree of female subordination is much less. So they are subordinated, but much lesser. So that's the first factor. The second factor is the Maoists turn up and offer empowerment. And so a lot of young hill women run off and do join the Maoists. They become educated at school. The choice is staying at home and marrying and becoming the most junior and inferior and exploited person in her husband's household, or joining the Maoists with their message of egalitarianism. So that comedy. Whereas My guess would be, and Poonam doesn't give us the full information here, and I'd like her to do so, but my guess would be all the fighters that she interviewed were not Madeshis, or very few were Madeshis. Because my theory is that in Madeshi society, the subordination of women is much, much greater. It's not to say there are not women among the Indian Naxalites. There are. But the number is not nowhere near the large number, and they haven't got nowhere near the same level of seniority as they have in Nepal. Okay, so on page 105, Poonam says, any attempt to assess the degree of transformation brought about in women's lives by social upheavals associated with the People's War must also attend to cultural diversity and therefore take account of the lived experience of Nepalese women from different sections of society. So that I absolutely agree with. That being the case, I think it would be great to have, in every case where an informant is being cited, to have their age, their caste, or ethnic background, their level of education and locality. Because that kind of contextual cultural information allows one to fully understand the force of what is being said. I think it would be great to contrast what Poonam has collected on Maoist female fighters with the work that has been done by Marie Lecomte-Tillouin and Michael Hutt, both of them have worked on Maoist memoirs. There's one extremely famous Maoist memoir by an ex-Maoist female fighter. And also with the work by Kiyoko Ogura. Unfortunately, most of it is in Japanese and that's not appeared in English. But some of it, I think, is available in English. Okay. So there are many questions that remain there's plenty of work still to be done on caste, class, gender, and land. But she's absolutely right the important thing and the interesting thing is to look at it in a bottom-up way, to look at unintended changes in culture that have been brought about. And that it's changed, and Poonam is absolutely right to emphasise that change doesn't arrive. It's certainly not a package which is delivered by the leaders. It's not something that just suddenly can be willed into existence by political elites. It's something that has to be brought about, actively brought about, by people themselves from the bottom up.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Marcia.
Okay, thank you. What I want to say was that, I was very struck by Poonam's presence in the Center for Women, Peace and Security as a visiting fellow, partly because I have my own research interests, which are now quite old. Christine mentioned that I've been doing research on peacekeeping really for the last 12 years, but my original doctoral work was looking at women's agency in the context of family decision-making in southern India. And so I think that Poonam and I shared an interest in turning away from a kind of dominant narrative that had appeared largely in Western feminist literature, which focused very heavily on women's victimization and the famous Mohanty model, the third world woman. And so maybe Poonam came to it from a very different place. Your own personal experiences of growing up in Nepal, your own observations and the pain and suffering you experienced as well within the context of war. I feel mine was a much more easy entry into it. But I think this external perspective perhaps was an impetus really to write this book and to write a different story about women in South Asia. So I just wanted to say I thoroughly enjoyed reading Poonam's book, especially after really 2 years now hearing snippets about the research study from Poonam in class, in conversations. And to sit down and read the book was actually really a real pleasure. I think the book has been of central importance to Poonam in the formation of, you know, in the development of her career, but very much so in her theoretical approach to understanding gender relations in post-conflict contexts. And I think since completing her book, Poonam has been inspired to think about a number of related issues. Poonam's started to think about looking at sexual and reproductive health of combatants, again, another issue that has been ignored in much of the investigations of Nepalese women's experiences of the conflict. She's working on a project on displacement and reconsidering the nexus between post-conflict and post-disaster events, as well as your sort of ongoing interest in minority women in Nepal and examining in this new study that Poonam is working on with other colleagues, looking at women's experiences in other contexts and trying to compare some of them, looking at women's experiences in Sri Lanka and possibly Colombia, to think about women's experiences, particularly in other Revolutionary War contexts. And I think one of the things that I learned about women in Nepal through Poonam's ethnographic study is that really that gender relations were transformed in so many positive ways and new opportunities were created through changes in the whole society, the geography and the culture. And again, the government had, you know, as David said, the government in some ways didn't play an important role in the actual development of the post-conflict society or the post-People's War society, but they were very much present in the context, and I think you document that so well. The presence of the state is so clear in the book, and that's very different than some other post-conflict contexts where the state is really absent and there's this, in a sense, there's a political vacuum, and I think Poonam's book really shows that there isn't that political vacuum or that space that's been created provided so many more opportunities. Poonam carefully outlines in her book the concept of social transformation, as you've heard, as she understands it, as in need of studying through the bottom up and through women's experiences of everyday life. And she moves from the empirical to the theoretical and back several times. And she shows how women's lives underwent radical change throughout Nepal. And she draws on, minimally she draws on four female figures context, which she explores through rich empirical examples. She looks at the way in which women, two moves. She looks at the way in which women entered traditional male spaces, in the context of women government representatives, but she also looks at the two sites, or at the one site that Christine and David both mentioned, these traditional public debating, these public forums, these public debating sites, and the tea stall ends up being a kind of a reformatted political forum. Actually, it's a public space in which women can actually speak and contribute to the transformation of Nepalese society. And the other two empirical examples that Poonam looks at are really about women entering traditional male occupations or traditional male roles. So she looks at female combatants and taxi drivers, more or less, yeah. I think this is really interesting, that the contrast between the spaces, the way in which the spaces are changed and repoliticized in order to incorporate women into those spaces, done mainly by women's labor, women's work, women's political activism, and the ways in which they take up roles traditionally associated with men. In addition, she examines how religious and patriarchal practices, such as those pertaining to widows, were challenged and transformed in these post-conflict moments. It's a very striking visual section of the book where she talks about the wearing of, the shift in wearing of the white saris, and that this is, at each time you go home, you see a sort of a reduction in these white saris. which is almost a kind of, it's both a kind of exciting trend, but there's also a kind of hint of melancholy in your account of it. There's something about, there's some kind of sadness in this transformation as well. But it, I think it's so important that Poonam is documenting this because, in a way, these are the kinds of histories, these are the kinds of archives of women's experiences that, you know, can so easily be passed by, and then there's no real record of it. So I think Poonam is making a major contribution to securing that that story. So the book is a comprehensive study. It's really amazing how much knowledge about Nepalese society is in here. I mean, I don't know how many archives and documents and data sets and books you must have read to find out all the competing statistics about literacy rates and marriage rates and there's just so much in here that, you know, it's it just shows you the kind of detail that Poonam was trying to show and reveal in terms of, you know, presenting this really complete picture. It documents well the political and labor market structures that form the backdrop to the war and that led to the new opportunities and temporal moments for change. And thus for Poonam, what she has contributed to the literature is that significant transformations in social and gender relations can be understood better if researchers pay attention to women's everyday experiences and lives. The research takes both the extraordinary and the everyday as sites within which to examine shifting gender norms and expectations. So although Poonam says that she's looking at the everyday lives and the everyday experiences, you really get a sense of the spectacular nature of these, right? You know, the reduction in the wearing of the white saris, the first time you saw the tea stall, these are quite exceptional kind of visual changes. And despite the compelling ethnographic and empirical account, you know, I really think, Poonam, you probably could have written another book, maybe another two in here, because there's so much in here. So I guess I just have a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you in relation to the book and to the future work that you're developing. And I think David also set some sort of questions to you to how you want to go about hopefully contributing to this, because I think there's so much more that you suggest needs to be done. So I have a couple questions, and they're kind of big, so don't feel like, you know, you need to respond very accurately to them, but they're just questions that were raised in my mind as I was reading it. I was wondering how you locate social transformation as the main framework for thinking about changes to women's everyday lives, because I really wanted to know what was the influence of the women's movement, of women's grassroots organizations, and feminist activism. How did they feature? And you know, you very strongly talk about social transformation as a kind of as a very difficult concept to work with. It's quite messy in a way, partly because so much has been written about it. But I guess in transforming women's lives and the changes that took place and the inspiration for these women to exercise autonomy and agency, I guess I was wondering, you know, and to actively insert themselves into this patriarchal system, why isn't, you know, gender your starting point? Why is social transformation your starting point, you know? Because it sort of assumes, in a sense, that gender is already fixed in that moment and that social transformation takes place in this kind of neat, contained way. And I guess I would want to ask you as well. I mean, I'm surprised that I'm asking this question based on where I come from in the Gender Institute, but I guess I really wanted to know where are the men, because the title of your book is A Gender Perspective. And I feel like, you know, you talk about the agency of women, but I guess you much more implicitly talk about the agency of men as reinforcing those patriarchal structures, or at least attempting to in many moments. So I guess maybe it's something that you might want to develop, or maybe not. Maybe you feel like this was the moment to really focus on the women and that you can need to continue doing that. And I guess, again, a related question is, why do you take the women's accounts as proof of social transformation? I mean, you know, in some parts of the book you talk about the different forts, the different, you use Bourdieu's concepts of capital, habitus, doxa, and, you know, in a sense, you're quite wedded to that. I mean, you're quite authentic to that theoretical framework, because those are very much embodied, those are very much subtle. But I guess I was wondering whether you wanted to use, and you introduced Foucault's notions in your, Foucault's ideas about the construction of knowledge and subjectivity, and I guess I wanted to know whether you would in future treat the women's experiences as also mediated accounts, right? You know, as their desire to show that the People's War didn't relegate them back into the domestic sphere, back into submission. So I was wondering whether you want to take that forward critically. And then I guess I have two other questions really about, you know, future commentaries, which I think David has partly touched on as well, which is about, you know, how did global development really feature in transforming the economic, political, social, cultural, and gendered relations? I mean, what role did these other actors, global actors, play? I mean, considering the domineering presence of India on the border, but also the kinds of development projects that were going that were taking place, the very modernizing agenda of global development actors in Nepal and around Nepal in the region. And, you know, I know you're thinking about this already, but I guess I was wondering what a comparative regional study would tell you about the similar patterns, processes, and practices in neighboring regions. You know, we've been discussing, you and I, also the connections between Bangladesh, the way in which women who were victims of war, who survived sexual violence in war, were also constructed as heroes of the nation, heroines of the nation. And it seems that there are more positive stories to tell about women's agency and about how women could be seen. And I think similarly in Sri Lanka, I know that you're looking at that as well. So I guess I'm just wondering what you think the comparative regional study might contribute to future work. So in closing, I want to say that I think Poonam's work has a great deal to contribute to studies of South Asia and of post-conflict gender relations. And I think her research clearly demonstrates that while war can cause extreme economic inequalities disproportionately affecting women, it can also produce spaces of agency, power, and transformation. And it is these spaces that we tend to pay so little attention to. And I think, as Poonam rightly implies in her book, these phenomena might help us to develop much more nuanced and complex responses to women's lives in the aftermath of conflict. And in this way, I think we must look at the variation in post-conflict gender relations so that we do not see war as a homogenous process which creates only and always female victims.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, I can understand that you're probably going to be answering Marcia and David's questions for the next, I don't know, sort of
25 years.
I was going to say, I don't think you'd do it all tonight. Would you like to take 3 or 4 minutes just to respond immediately, or would you like to open it straight out to the floor? Are there some immediate responses that you'd like to make to both
briefly,
of them?
Yeah.
Yes, but, yeah.
Yeah, I might not be able to all of the...
Well, I think you could do that over the next few.
Over the next few weeks. So I actually have, just to answer David's question about considering including, having more in-depth analysis of caste, class, and ethnicity, I have tried to do a bit of intersectional analysis, but I haven't done that in detail because the focus of the research was kind of different. I was just trying to theorize social transformation by putting women's lived experience at the center of analysis. So therefore, intersectional analysis was not the focus of my research, and that's why I limited, but then that's definitely an area I should expand. And I also felt that I need to bring more different perspective from different caste groups, different class, and different region. So for the sample, I only interviewed about 59 women, and I also conducted a few focus group discussions. But I try to make sure my sample were from various regions within Nepal, like from far western region, mid western region, eastern region, and central region. And the women who were in the Maoist, although I haven't said that explicitly there, women, the Maoist women were also from Terai, and also and they were also from Nepal. So there is a representation of women from both sides, like from the Madhes as well as from the hills. But then it doesn't come very explicitly because of the focus of my analysis was kind of directing towards. I was trying to prove my point of social transformation, and therefore that was kind of missed. But then I'll definitely consider that in my future work. Marsha, okay, so actually... So the focus was on social transformation, and I was saying social transformation is a shift in discursive habitus. It's not something structural, it's not something political, it's not something that is coming from top down. It's a bottom up process. The top down is a contributing factor, but it's actually a bottom up process. Social transformation is a continuous process. It starts with the individuals. But then when I'm talking about different cases, like war widows, and when I'm talking about white sari, I talk about the contribution that international organizations and national organizations and women rights activists have actually contributed to that movement. So when I talk about red color movement, this is all about women's movement, how women's movement actually contributed to the transformation. So these women, these widows, all of a sudden Nepal had lots of young widows, and it had very strict cultural restrictions on these widows, and in post-conflict Nepal they didn't know how to deal with it because they were all young. It was not their fault. Before it was seen as women's bad fortune and bad luck, but now they cannot say that because men went to war and they were killed. So society had no idea how to deal with the situation, so they were kind of flexible. At the same time, there were money coming from international communities to help the victims of conflict, and these war widows were the victims of conflict. So this organization, which was established in 1994, had no funding until middle of the war, and then they started getting funding, and then with that funding they started organizing these women. So they started with small meetings, so gathering few war widows, and then they started saying their problems, and then they realized actually it is not them who are suffering, but it's the story of everyone. Everyone had similar kind of stories, so they learned from each other. And then they started a movement called Red Color Movement. So avoid white sari. Widows had to wear white sari when their husband died. But actually, it looks like it's just a performance, just a clothing. But it had actually a huge impact. When women were wearing white sari, they felt it reminded them of their loss. Every time they felt that they don't have, that they are single, and they were attacked, they were the target by for this kind of advantages, because they were recognized. I mean, people could recognize them from distance that these women are widows because they are wearing white sari. But when women started getting together, and when this international NGO came and said, and then brought religious leaders to educate them, saying that this is not something that you have to do. This is not something religious. You don't have to do. This is something cultural. You can just leave it. You don't need to wear white sari. And then started avoiding white sari. And that just by avoiding white sari, the transformation that has taken place is quite remarkable, because women were restricted from eating different. They could not. They were not allowed to eat different kinds of food that all the normal women can. They were not allowed to go to public meetings and community level, any kinds of meetings. But after they avoided wearing white sari, they started wearing other colors. They were seen as normal women, and people could not recognize them as widows. So they treated them like other normal women, and they were allowed to go to public events and attended public events. So there is a contribution of women women's rights activist as well as international community.
Why don't we leave it at that and let other people come in? Because otherwise, I think we'll be dropping the floor. And there's so much,
we can discuss it, you and I.
I think Marsha said how much is in the book. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's 170 pages with all of this wealth of information. And you can also hear just how much more Poon Emma's got on that. But, other people got other... It's sort of about 10 minutes or so, quarter of an hour. So, if any sort of questions or... Yes, could you just please say who you are?
My name is Fergus Anderson, and I work for President Carter as the peace monitors during last with David back in 2013, and I've had experience of living in West Nepal for over 25 years now, so maybe comment a little bit on the Terai, particularly in Bardia and Bardia and the Balganj. But the question I was going to ask was much more general, and I have thousand million questions for you. But one of them would be, did you see that there was, well, we were talking earlier on about how women empowerment is the cadres, as they were within the Maoist organisation. Did you find a similar sort of rise in empowerment for any women that were involved with the Videshi uprising from 2008 onwards? And maybe you may wish to mention why there was an uprising for people that don't know Nepal very well, where there was the Maoist war to the centre, but the Videshi was, as David mentioned, was, it was seen as a colony, really annexed or connected onto the north of India. But that would be my question. Was any empowerment seen by the Videshi?
Should we take a couple more of this? So first there, and then here, and then come back.
Yes,
and can you again say, who you are?
Yes, my name is Sarah Bapati. I'm a PhD student at SOAS. My project is on law and peace agreement, and my case study is in Nepal. My question is, we spoke about social transformation and change for women in Nepal after the war, and I would like to ask you if you could expand a bit on how much do you think this change is durable? Do you think it's going to be durable or not? Because sometimes it happens that after war we see like a bit of change for women, positive, and then regression to before.
Thank you. Here was it? Yes.
I'm Aisha. I'm from a lecturer. I'm in St. George's in UCL. And I currently have a project in Afghanistan on lived experiences of women post-conflict. So I was interested in the white sari as a form of disclosure as being a widow. And in the interviews that you gathered, did they represent any form of storytelling or narratives that could be also part of the transformation in Nepal about other forms of stories of being a widow?
Were people able to hear that at the back?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other before sort of hang back? Okay.
Yes, so after answering your question, after the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2006, lots of other kinds of ethnic conflicts emerged in Nepal. So Madhesi movement was one of them. So as David already said, Madhesi is like the plains of Nepal. There are many districts, and about 50% of the population live in Terai, although there is disputed statistics. Some say 15%, some say 30%, and actually 50% of the population, I should say, live in the plains of Nepal. So people of the Terai started protesting against all kinds of discriminations, because although the Hill community was somehow dependent on the Terai, but then they were always they had always been discriminated. They were always discriminated by the state. So people after I started this movement in 2007, and lots of women actually took part in this movement as well. They came, and the literacy rate is very, very low in the Terai, the plains of Nepal. But then even though they were illiterate, they just came and participated. They thought, this is for us, this is for our rights, and we need to go and fight. So lots of women participated. And in my book, one of the chapters is about Tea Stall Story, where I talk about one of the women who was a servant working in someone else's house near my parents' house, she was asked to cook for the people who were actually protesting in that movement, and she was a she was from a poor family, so she took that as an opportunity and then started cooking for them. Later she got interested and then she got involved in that movement as well, because she thought, this is for us, this is for people like us. And because of her involvement and the strong discourse of social inclusion in Nepal, in post-conflict Nepal, where they're talking about including people from all caste and ethnicity and economic background, she was the hot cake at that time, because she was coming from the lower caste, very poor family and women. So, and then if you have, if your party is more inclusive, then you get more sympathetic vote from the people. So therefore, she became a kind of hotcake. So she got the opportunity to become the CA member. And there, but then she doesn't know how to read and write. She had never been to school. There were other women also who had never been to school, but they became the Constituent Assembly members. So basically, the leaders of the country who were there to write the constitution of the new constitution of the country. So she was Devi is one of the examples, but there are other women without any political background, with no education, also got the opportunity. So Mothers Movement did provide some opportunity for these women as well. But then I have talked in a little bit details in my book that post-conflict space was kind of open and empowering for all kinds of women, not just women from the Pahad, not just women who were directly involved in the People's War, but other women also. It was like spillover effect, I would say. So the whole space was kind of flexible and accommodative to including demands of women as well. So whether change is durable, I get this question every time I present, and therefore the way I explain what social transformation is kind of different from what we have understood so far. So for me, social transformation is a shift in discursive habitus, the way we think, the way we believe, the way we do things, and therefore I talk about performativity. So when people have new knowledge, I talk about Foucault and his discursive discourse. So when people have new knowledge, they think differently. When they think differently, they perform differently. When they perform differently, they are perceived differently. And therefore, actually it leads to transformation. So therefore, I'm saying it is a shift in discursive habitat. If there is a shift in discursive narratives, then it actually leads to social transformation. And I'm not saying social transformation is a radical shift, and it has to be a radical shift. It is a combination of small shifts that actually occurs, and it needs a push, and the conflict actually was a push factor that provided an opportunity for critical reflexivity, and that critical reflexivity actually led to social transformation. I'm not sure how clear I am, but I'm very clear in my book, and I explain it very well. So the other forms of story of widowhood. So I just want to cite an example. I was working for a development NGO in Nepal in 2008, I think. I went to the field, and then my colleagues who were male, he said, they were saying, Poonam, why don't you go to that? There was a small fair, and they had food stall and lots of other things. It was a local fair organized by the business community. We just went there in the evening, and my colleague from my organization, he said, why don't you go to that stall? I said, let's go, all of us can go together and eat that really nice sel roti and then curry, like donut kind of stuff. And they said, no, we don't want to go. I said, why? Because they are single women. So widows were actually now, widows are now known as single women. And these single women were actually, although they were allowed after the movement started to operate some kind of small businesses, but even at that time, that was the perception. But now there is no such perception whatsoever. And also, the whole perception, people's perception about widowhood had changed, and therefore I talk about social transformation. I don't only talk about social change. So when I'm talking about social transformation, although I'm bringing examples, accounts of women, women's lived experiences, I then relate that back to the social structure, how the society is reacting to that, and what society how society is perceiving. So I haven't actually interviewed many men, but I interviewed a few, And I have actually stated in my book, when I start my book, I say, although I'm talking about gender perspective, I'm talking about women, not about men. But then I have actually talked to few men, and of course, in my focus group discussion, in my, especially when I was talking to some policymakers, I have also considered their account and what they think about women's status in post-conflict Nepal. So there is like men's perception there too, but in broader sense, not like in details. Yeah.
Any further questions? Yes.
Hi.
We'll take two more. Yes, right.
Okay. I'm Charlotte. I'm finishing my PhD in film violence and political philosophy, so I'm very new to this real-world violence thing, although a lot of the films I look at reflect on these issues. I was wondering about what you said about combat roles as a social transformation for women. Women who are allowed to participate in armed combat, is that exclusively women who are widows, or is that open to other types of women?
Yeah. Well, take the other one. Was it? Hey, wait. Yes.
I'm Isabella. I'm from Colombia. I'm doing a master in the Gender Institute. I was working in women participation in the peace process back in Colombia until some months ago. I just wanted to know a little bit more about the role of the state in the social transformation. That I put some of the speakers talk a little bit about it. But that's basically.
Any last questions? This will be the last round, so last opportunity. Okay, well, if you...
So women in combat roles, as David said, there were more than 33% women's representation in the Maoist movement. But then now, since women were actually in the Nepal army before, but they were only in non-combat roles. But since the Maoist movement started, women had to the state had to combat and the fight with the Maoist. So they started recruiting women in combat roles as well. And now they are increasing it. So there is kind of they have a policy to recruit women in every recruitment. They have to have 9% women's participation. So it's open to everyone, not just to widows. So anyone can actually apply and become part of the Nepal Army.
If something had changed by a woman doesn't have a man if they're suddenly allowed to participate in that, but I guess it's open to everyone.
Yeah, it's open to everyone, yeah. So the role of the state in social transformation. It goes back to the question of whether social transformation is top-down or bottom-up, and I'm talking about bottom-up approach. Definitely there are some contributing factors that have contributed to the transformation process, and state interventions are also contributing factors. So I take them, the state intervention, as contributing factors. For instance, changes in policies. So government has actually changed lots of gender discriminatory policies. So especially the new amendment, 12th, I think, amendment in the not constitution, the law of Nepal, removed like 116 discriminatory provisions. So women all have the right now to property. They can inherit property from their parents. We have new abortion law. We have other kinds of law, new rape law, new laws, and many other things which are gender friendly. And also, the government is, it's like post-conflict kind of transitional state, like fragile state, and kind of open, and I don't know how to describe it. It's very like some of the organs, I just do not want to generalize, because if you go to one ministry, then you will see different structure there, and they're quite open. They want to actually implement programs that are friendly to women and all that kind of stuff. If you go to another ministry, you will see completely different picture. So therefore, I do not want to generalize, but state has been contributing to some extent to this transformation by being open, by revising the policies and programs and laws.
Thank you. Is this a very quick?
Can I throw in one really quick question? Just to follow up from the Columbia example, I'm very young, doing my master's here in anthropology at the moment. In the Colombian case, there seems to be like less flexibility in terms of women's ability to engage in social transformation. And I was thinking, in terms of reconciliation, how would you link this to changes in habitus and discursive habitus? How would you sort of relate the notions of reconciliation with this? So how would you negotiate reconciliation whilst empowering and whilst sort of changing habitus?
Reconciliation, like you're talking about interventions for reconciliation, is it?
Because there's certain things that policy and legislation just cannot change, like you can't force someone to forgive or forget.
Yeah.
So how are these being negotiated within?
Yeah, so there are different. Yeah, that's right. So in my book, in all of the examples that I have presented, I'm not saying this is a complete transformation. So there are, I talk about different fields that Bourdieu talks about. So you have cultural field, you have political field, you have social field, and you have different kinds of field and different sub-fields within those fields. So some of them have actually transformed, but whereas some of them have not, and therefore there is tension every now and again. So for instance, these combatants who actively participate, and they're quite empowered, they can go and talk to anybody. I interviewed one of the combatants recently when I was in Nepal in July. They're quite forward, but then when it comes to giving power, the state is not giving, even their own party is not giving the power. So there is this mismatch, and you can see this mismatch everywhere, but that doesn't mean that social transformation hasn't occurred. Her life has changed. When you talk to her, what matters to us is that what she thinks about her life and how society is seeing her perception, her status or existence. So she thinks that she is empowered and she prefers her present life than the life she would have had if she was she hadn't joined the Maoist movement. There are lots of problems. There are lots of still deny like. Women are accepted in certain positions, denied in certain positions. When it comes to leadership, they are accepted in certain positions. So in Nepal, we have a female president. We have female chief of justice. Lots of women have been promoted to a really senior position in the police, the Nepalese police and army. But then at the same time, sometimes we are not given opportunity, even though they deserve or even though they are actually qualified for that. So it's very complex. And therefore, I talk about complexity, multiplicity, and the relation, I mean, in certain space. So, DDR process wasn't gender friendly. Women have not been benefited from the DDR process. Security sector reform, if you look at it, if you research about security sector reform in post-colonial Nepal, you'll find lots of gendered components there and kind of disappointing. But then if you look at other aspects, there are progress.
Would either of you like to make a last minute comment? Or
I just insert a commercial, which is if you're interested in post-conflict reconciliation, Mandira Sharma is going to be speaking about it in Nepal, she's going to be talking about it in SOAS on the 17th of November, about the whole, and she's one of the leading human rights activists who was responsible for the Colonel Lama case that was brought in this country. So okay. Very much worth hearing.
Okay, thank you. Marsha?
No, I think we'll
play.
Punam and I need to meet and talk more.
Okay, well, yeah. Thank you very much. Just before I thank everybody, two things. Further events for the centre, which if people are interested. Later on this week, on Thursday night, we have a discussion on women's human rights and access to justice for gender-based violence, a view from legal practice in the United Kingdom, with a number of practitioners, and looking particularly at a report on access to justice, which is at 6:30 Thursday night in the Wolfson Theatre, so I hope people will be interested in that. And then in sort of Human Rights Week, December, this is actually on December the 6th, panel discussion again on working on gender equality in fragile contexts. So, dates for the diary. Come and join us for a drink outside now. Everybody is invited.
and thank all the panelists, and especially Poonam, for presenting the book, but also very